Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Stand by for Operation Wilson Exercise. Stand by for Operation Wilson Exercise.
This is the Toffee Web Podcast.
Hello, Blues. Welcome to the Toffee Web Podcast for the week beginning the 27th of November 2023, where we'll be looking back at what was, depending on your viewpoint, either a game against superior opposition to be quickly forgotten, or a pretty demoralizing result that leaves us with quite the hole to climb out of in the coming weeks. I'm Lyndon Lloyd, back on intro duties after being ably deputized by Andy Howard last week. Andy isn't available this time, and Paul Trail is unfortunately under the weather, but Adam McCulloch and Al Bretland are here with me to discuss that defeat to United and look ahead to Saturday's trip to the City Ground, where Everton will face Nottingham Forest. Al, where are you after that 3-0 defeat and the club's position in general in terms of the fight to avoid relegation for a third successive season now? Assuming, of course, we don't get any of those deducted points back.
Yeah, I think the season really does depend on that home form. It's got to improve. I think we were all right to be very optimistic before the points deduction. You know, it was as we said on the previous podcast, it was the furthest distance away we'd been from the relegation zone. It really felt like a weight had been lifted. So in true Everton style over the last few years, you know, we were brought back to earth with a bump, and you know, it was tough. And then when you look at the results, you know, Everton lost, Luton won, and all of a sudden it's a 5-point gap. I think it's the psychology, isn't it? And I think that's going to be really interesting for how the players cope, because, you know, I think we were all confident. I honestly just expected us to blow Man United away purely because the atmosphere. Because I always think you can feel it in the air when Everton are going to win. I think one of the only things that could have happened on the planet happened with Garnacho scoring an absolutely stunning goal. And, you know, I think we were all very confident, rightly so. But then when you take a step back, you know, I read someone say, you know, imagine if you'd worked really hard in your own job and your bosses had cost you a project or work, you would be very deflated, yeah. I think. So I think Sean Dyche has got a big job on his hands, really, to boost the players. But I think as the season goes on now, I think the Chelsea-Newcastle home games are massive, because for me now, I think we've got enough sort of results to look at. And Sean Dyche's home-away record, I think, is very similar to the whole Roberto Martinez attack v defence. I feel like it's, you know, he's clearly very good at one system. But at home, I'm leaving Goodison I'm feeling very unfulfilled in what I'm watching. Because I think, you know, you look at the XG, you look at the chances Everton are creating, and I see it, but I'm not feeling it. I'm not coming out of games thinking that Everton did dominate. I'd say that, you know, watching Ashley Young, Harrison, Decore and Gay, it's like watching a pinball machine. There's legs everywhere, the ball's moving in different directions. And, you know, soon enough that ball is gonna end up in that gap that you don't want it to go in. There's not a lot of composure at home. And I think when you're away from home, because that home team is meant to be in the ascendancy and has the backing of the fans, when you lose those scrappy balls, it's okay almost because you get another chance. If you lose the ball at Goodison, there's a feeling, isn't there? There's a collective groan, there's a pressure. And I think that it is like night and day at the minute. So I think, you know, Forest is a winnable game. It's a big one. But for me, I feel like the season is going to be defined by that Chelsea-Newcastle game, whether or not, as we've said in the past, is it going to be mid-table mediocrity or are we going to have a battle on our hands? Because as we saw last season as well, the Bournemouth-Leicester game for Lampard going into that World Cup break, it's an important time of year now where, you know, there'll be a lot of games. You'll have the FA Cup. We've got the League Cup to contend with. And it's about getting that feel-good factor back. So, you know, I think Man United were one of the worst teams we could have played, really. In that sense, you know, I know that they're not the best side, but they are on a good run of form and they've got players of quality who can score the best goal I've ever seen live. It was just stunning. And you could just... The atmosphere was one of the best I've been in. And as soon as that goal went in, it just went quiet, and it was such a good goal. I almost lost myself and wanted to share, like, with people, like, oh my God. And obviously, I'm in Gladys Street, it was just angry scowl, you know, all scowls on people's faces. So, yeah, for me, the big word for me is the sense of feeling is just unfulfillment. I'm going to Goodison. I'm seeing Everton create chances, but it's almost like I'm not convinced by it. You know, it's 5 defeats now. And especially earlier in the season, the Wolves-Fulham game, I know that a lot of people thought Everton were unlucky, but I never agreed with that view. And for me, it's not really changed further down the line.
Yeah, it's hard to put your finger after the game, whether it's been sort of battling and gutsy and chances have been created, or you've just watched a real wasted opportunity. The pinball analogy is perfect, and there was also a lot of kind of static lumbering, the kind of people you'd expect to sort of walk up to a pinball machine as well on show. It's great that we're creating chances. And I think you're absolutely right as well, Al, that if one thing could have really punctured all that build up, and I'm sure all of the work that's been done on the training ground, not just in the build up, but also obviously during an international break where a lot of the players we're back at Finch Farm. If one thing could have punctured it, I mean, even, I don't know, even an early red card, if someone was really too fired up and we had a man sent off, you feel like even member crowd still would have felt gelled with the occasion. But seeing a goal like that, it's not just your manager messing up the project, it's your manager coming in and doing such a good job of messing up the project that you're sort of taken aback by the sheer brazenness of it. It was a stunning goal, and I had the same kind of reaction of, oh God, but also fair enough, because if you're going to score, then I guess, yeah, do it like that. That was essentially the difference between the two sides on Sunday evening. They had quality, they had some composure. Obviously that moment there was a one in a, if not a million, then more opportunity taken. But the third goal, that little bit of composure, they didn't have to try too hard to get that. And it's the feeling I've had coming away from some of the games, not just under Deitch, in fairness, of recent years, where we've gone into these games, probably post-Moyes, if not sort of early Martinez, where we've gone into games like this, where I've thought, oh, this is a team who are there for the taking. This is a team who are builders favourites. But actually, I think we're favourites. I fancy us. And I really did believe that we'd lay a glove on them. And that's where it's a little hard to analyse, which isn't great 7 minutes into a podcast record for me to admit. But it's I come away from it going, well, did we do what we set out to do there? I'm still a bit unsure, because there were some great opportunities. There were chances on another day that if they go in, the game's different. There was a penalty decision, which on reflection was the right call, but still could have gone either way. Certainly did in the moment. And you could come away from it going, well, 3-0's probably an unfair result in terms of the margin of victory. But also there's that nagging sense of we really, really could have done more there. And I feel a big part of that responsibility lies with the manager in these games, because we have enough evidence now that sadly against the so-called bigger teams, and I think lumping Manchester United in with that is difficult. They're a difficult side to pigeonhole. I've said that in the build-up to the game, and I still say it having watched them for 90 minutes. They're hard to pin down, but they're not quite as good as we make them look, certainly. And I feel like it's one of those results that I don't think it'll come back to bite us, but it felt like an opportunity, I should say, to really take away some of the noise, some of the pressure, some of the external stuff ahead of an appeal at the end of this week, it seems. If we're going into this strange winter of discontent, knowing that 10 points we probably can't bank on that coming back, or at least a portion of it coming back, then I need to see a bit more from the side than I saw on Sunday. And I think, to your point as well, Elle, the home crowd at Goodison needs to see more, because that's really where, over the past couple of seasons, we've got out of jail, and the fans need something back beyond, well, the possession stats were up a bit and the chances were up a bit, and oh, well, at least we're a bit better than Lampard. We're 10 points worse off than we should be, so we kind of need to be 10 points better than we were under there, if that makes sense with my maths. Lyndon, you take over of it.
No, that all makes sense, and I completely agree. I mean, the home... Yeah, exactly. The home form, and particularly against the better teams, in quotes, the top teams in quotes, is the thing that actually worries me. I mean, if you think back to those really important matches under Lampard where we beat United at home, Chelsea at home, Newcastle at home, and results that we really, really needed, and the crowd was up for it, and the crowd was really amped up. We've not been able to match that under Deitch, and that's the thing that's starting to concern me, is the performances, particularly at home against these sides, where we've played Arsenal, not laid a glove on them. We've played Manchester United and, you know, sort of tried to lay a glove on them, and as you've said, failed with some fairly poor execution in the final third, which is becoming, again, you know, a theme of the season at Goodison Park. I mean, I was, like pretty much everybody else, going into that game against United thinking this is an opportunity and we're going to take it, because, you know, the wave of anger and the wave of, and the unity and the, just the atmosphere is going to be so much that how could we not? And it was that same kind of feeling in Duncan Ferguson's first game. And again, some of those really sort of high octane, memorable games under Lampard, and the Arsenal game, home game against under Sean Dyche. I foresaw another one of those occasions where United, who've had their own, I mean, obviously they came in as the form team of the last few weeks, but they've had their own issues. They're fallible. They can be got at. But I mean, I'm sure Erik ten Hag would have said to them, look, just control the early exchanges, which they did. You know, take the sting out of it, which they did. And obviously, I mean, you can't legislate for a goal like that. I mean, it was just, I mean, excuse my language, but I just said, oh, fuck off. You know, I mean, how could, you know, just honestly, could you just not save that for any other match, you know? But yeah, so it's those performances against these bigger teams that concern me, given that the next few games are obviously against Newcastle, Chelsea and City. Those are the next three home games before the end of the year. And I apologies to anyone who listens to the Blue Room Subs Weekly, because I said some of this stuff earlier today on that. But that is my concern, is that we're not, you know, our home form against even the lesser sides has been an issue. But against these bigger teams, we're not following through in the same way that we did under Lampard, and maybe some of that's to do with the fact that we just don't have someone like Richarlison who can find that clinical moment, you know, in a game to score what often is the only goal that we need. You know, having to rely on scoring the first goal every time is a problem, particularly against these kinds of teams who can control a game from the off, as we know the likes of City can, and you know, Chelsea are a bit of an unknown quantity this season. They've been a bit up and down, but again, like United, they have quality in their ranks, and that's always a danger. The quality can get you out of jail, you know, on a number of occasions, and unfortunately, we just don't have it consistently enough. So that's the concern for me. But Al, obviously, you and I weren't on last week's podcast, but I wanted to know if you wanted to have any thoughts in general about the deduction, about the penalty, the punishment that obviously has been meted out to Everton by this so-called independent panel.
Yeah, well, I know I've had my like conspiracy theories on this podcast before about certain, you know, refereeing decisions, but I think, you know, I think Evertonians are right to feel aggrieved, and that, you know, there is more to it than just a cut and dry, Everton have broke the rules and, you know, that's the deduction. I think what's disappointing is I think that the Premier League want to be self-regulated. They don't want any outside, you know, people coming in to take that over from them. And I think it's very easy, as some other people have said, to throw the deduction at Everton. And, you know, for me as well, it's, you know, a lot has been made of Everton and in the situation, but it's also the other teams down there as well, how they're affected. Because, you know, I've read today that Everton are likely to lodge an appeal this week. What happens if Luton, you know, work their backsides off to get clear of us, and then all of a sudden, with 2 months to go, we're back above them? I just think there's a lot of things that you look at and think, well, you know, how unfair is it on Everton? How unfair is it on the league? And, you know, I've said many times that the state of the referee, and nobody is in a true position in the league table. And this is just, it almost feels like another void season, almost, because so many things have gone wrong. You know, I think the outside media and, you know, rival fans have maybe got the wrong end of the stick through our, you know, disappointments. You know, not one Evertonian has said that we didn't break the rules. You know, we've seen that we have. But really, for me, it's the rules are wrong. Yeah, we've gone 19 million over, but on Sunday we faced a football club who are £1 billion in debt, and it was the most expensive squad in football currently at 1.15 billion. Now, people point to Man United's revenue. They could pay it off whenever they like. So why haven't they? It's because it gives them an advantage.
Right, 100%.
So, do you know what I mean? There's lots of different factors to it. And, you know, again, another point, you know, the 105 million figure, it's been there for about 10 years now. What about inflation? And then, you know, the overriding thing is that Everton, quite simply, are trying to better themselves. Yes, they've made mistakes in the transfer market, but at the end of the day, Goodison Park doesn't sufficiently give them enough money anymore. I remember years ago hearing about the Emirates. I think the Emirates makes more money from their boxes than Goodison does on a match day. And if you think, how long's the Emirates been there now? Over a decade. So yeah, for me, I just think I don't dispute that Everton have broke the rules, but it just seems very unfair. And it does. It feels like it's quite easy to corner Everton and punish them to make yourself, you know, be seen to be doing the right thing. And as well, what's really disappointing is Sky Sports as well. You know, if it's true that they have, you know, interviewed Andy Burnham and decided not to show it, if it's true that, you know, they maybe didn't have the mics as they usually would at Goodison. You know, I don't know how true these things are, but, you know, as a sports broadcaster, you know, we're one of the 20 teams in the Premier League, which is a massive brand. And if Evertonians are angry about something, they should report on it. It's as simple as that, really. If Evertonians decide to fly a plane over Manchester City versus Liverpool, the top two clubs, that's not irrelevant. That's a big story that you should say, by the way, there's a football match going on, but there's a plane overhead, you know, and this affects the whole league. Yeah.
There were two. Yeah. That's a mad thing. Yeah. There's two. Neither got them.
So, I think for me, really, there's just a sense of disappointment, unfairness. And it sort of proves what Evertonians have felt for a few decades now, that, you know, we're not seen as relevant or as important. And, you know, those clubs that are seen as important, the ones that make the most money, the top six, they're the ones who tried to blow English football apart only a few years ago. And they got a slap on the wrist. And, you know, as we mentioned at the start of the show, the players have worked hard to earn their 14 points. And they've got to go again now through no fault of their own. So, yeah. Just really disappointing, and I hope that, you know, the Premier League and the independent commission can see some sense in that, and, you know, listen to the points that have been made and you know, make amends for that.
Yeah, no, yeah. I was just going to say we've obviously waited the full allocated 14 days to lodge an appeal by the sounds of it, so that's going to go through on Friday. I guess I'm going to take that as a positive that we've waited as long as possible, that hopefully we've lawyered up, that we've, you know, splashed some cash in that area at least. And we fight this because I think obviously the fan base on Sunday and since then, we spoke about this last week as well, is galvanised and is, I think, united on the sense that, yes, something's been done wrong, but no, this isn't the way it should be punished. And I think when I speak to other people away from Everton, my sense is that there's a bit of, you know, a bit of joshing, a bit of joking. In some cases, it's more negative. But I think pretty much everyone's unanimous in the sense that this is far too great a punishment. And I think that's our one kind of get out, that I think if that can be a sort of suspended points penalty, or if it at least comes down to an extent, then hopefully results like Sunday, and when I say results like Sunday, I mean the likes of bloody Palace every time, you know, that Luton result, which I shouldn't care about as much. And you're right as well, Al, but the thing is, this whole season, a bit like the COVID seasons, it has that asterisk in your head next to a lot of things already, because, you know, we could have a 10-point penalty and who knows what will happen to other sides further up the table if rules are followed, shall we say. But let's hope it just comes down enough so that we can at least focus on football to an extent, because I feel like we shouldn't let it die down. I don't think the fans will. I think the drum is being beaten loudly, and I think as well, it's worth saying, other sides around there, you mentioned Luton, I think the general sense around the Premier League, certainly my feeling at the moment, is just distaste, really. And Wolves against Fulham on Monday, I mean, VAR is an aberration. And I think that's changed the way a lot of people view the game. And it's solidified a lot of that. You said conspiracy theories, Al, but the fact is there's a kind of vacuum around there. So you have to fill it with something. If Sky Sports News aren't necessarily being impartial, if you have a manager like Gary O'Neill at Wolves, I thought spoke very well and very eloquently about their results. And I think we've kind of got to do the same. But there comes a point where you have to be a bit nasty and a bit gnarly about it and go, hold on a minute. Is this independent? Hold on a minute. Is this fair and just? Hold on a minute. What about X team? What about Y team? So hopefully that's what we're doing. And hopefully they don't get me in as a lawyer, because it just ramble on like that.
I mean, it is a bit farcical, as you say, in terms of how, you know, teams navigate the rest of the season. We have no idea how long this appeal process is going to take. Hope it'll only just be a matter of weeks, you know, once this appeal goes in by Friday. And we'll, you know, hopefully we'll know in good time. All the teams will know basically where they stand. But yeah, I mean, it is the whole thing is just a farce. And, you know, this notion of conspiracy theories filling a vacuum. I mean, that line, L, about United, you know, choosing not to pay off their debt because it's a sporting advance. I mean, that just crystallizes it in a nutshell for me. You know, and then that's not to even mention the extent to which Chelsea have been, as I put in my article on the website this morning, the way that to the extent that Chelsea have been bending the rules with, harvesting players and sending them out on loan, giving players 7-8 year contracts to enable to spread the payments out over the lifetime of a contract to essentially spend far more than they would otherwise be allowed to do. I mean, and when it comes down to it, if we're talking about a £19.5 million issue here, when you put it up against those numbers that these other clubs are spending and the debt that they're incurring, it makes you incredulous that Everton have been punished to the extent that they have. Obviously, the more stuff that comes out in the media about their decision making process, the more we're finding out of how the nuts and bolts of this worked, and it appears as though the league were making this up as they went along. Because they've come up with this formula retrospectively while the appeals process, while the commission, not before it deliberated, but while it was awaiting to deliberate on Everton's case. And they've decided that, you know, that the punishment for Everton's transgression in the first place should be 6 points. And then it was going to be 1 point for every 5 million that we're over. So let's assume, for argument's sake, we were 60, 70 million over. You know, how many points then do you then deduct? And at what point does it just become ridiculous? Now, in Manchester City's case, you're not talking about a monetary figure that they have gone over. You're talking about 115 different charges related to, you know, failure to report and misleading the Premier League and all the rest of it. So what's the formula there for a points deduction? The whole thing just makes no sense to me. And it's, you know, how can you... I don't know how you can operate a league of this size and scope on those kinds of rules. Go ahead, Al.
But as well, Everton have already had their hands tied behind their back, because when we asked the Premier League for help and guidance and we went to them, we signed Andros Townsend on a free, Begovic on a free, Rondon on a free. You know, if we were allowed to spend as City, Chelsea, everyone else does, we'd have signed a new goalkeeper for money. We'd have paid money for a winger, paid money for a striker. Perhaps, you know, Beto could have come in 2 years earlier. And then that's a better Everton squad. So we've already been punished in that sense that we've not been allowed to spend as freely as anybody else, despite not spending anywhere near as much. Yeah. And if you look at the net spend, I know that the whole sustainability is much more than net spend, but somebody showed a graph, and the first 9 teams alphabetically in the Premier League, in the last 3 seasons, it's only Brighton and Everton who are in green every season. Every other club is in red. And the thing for me, it's the Premier League have these sustainability rules, but they're throwing TV money at all 20 clubs. Bournemouth made, I think, 1.9 million from player sales and spent 127 million euros. They signed players from Roma, from Lyon. This is Bournemouth who, you know, no disrespect, they've got a very tiny stadium in Premier League terms, so they're not going to make a load of money out of that. I don't expect many people outside of the Bournemouth fan base are buying Bournemouth shirts. You know, this is a club, in terms of sustainability, as sad as it is, Bournemouth are probably, you know, probably do have that glass ceiling. But the Premier League are throwing money at everyone. And I think it's very careless of the Premier League, because your Bournemouths and your Lutons, they're not going to be able to compete for about 30 years if FFP is true. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're spending well beyond their means. And surely it's going to catch up with them. You know, Bournemouth, 127 million in one summer. It's just astounding. And you look at it, nobody, you know, all the clubs, nobody in the league table really surprises you. The team who've made the biggest leap is Brighton. And that's because they're a properly run club. It's not because they've taken advantage of TV money. So for me, it's very hypocritical of the Premier League to have FFP rules and to supposedly care about sustainability when they're given relatively small football clubs over 100 million to spend as part of, you know, the monopoly of the Premier League. So that for me is, I think, over the next few seasons, I wouldn't be surprised if 3 or 4 teams have got minus 10 because of everybody's going to try and overspend to compete, and it's all going to come and bite them on the bum. And so I think the Premier League have caused it through sheer greed, basically. You know, they will sell the broadcast rights for so much money, and they're just dishing it out to the clubs. And where's it going to end? You know, the bubble will burst because, as I say, it's just not sustainable for a club like Bournemouth to spend 127 million. It's just not.
Yeah, and the extension of that argument is related to the Champions League, is that teams like Everton have been overspending to try and get into the Champions League because this group of six clubs has had a lock on those positions for so long, and as we saw, have made various moves to try and, you know, consolidate that hold on though, and to try and keep other clubs out. And so the only way that we could really try and get in there was to overspend. The great irony of it is that a lot of fans weren't really on board with some of this outlandish spending. I mean, I'm on record as saying that paying £45 million for Gylfi Sigurdsson was absolute insanity. We paid twice as much as we should have done for him. There was no competition for Davy Klaassen when we paid 20-odd million for him. You know, John Philippe Gbagbon might have been the same case. We overspent on players. We you know, dished out enormous salaries, which we saddled with enormous, you know, enormous wage bill for 5-6 years. That wasn't the fans who did that. This was the ownership who did that. And yet now, with most of the ownership on the way out or gone, we are the ones who have to deal with it.
Yeah, and the reason Swansea were able to ask for 45 million was because they had Premier League money in the bank.
Right.
So it's almost like the Premier League has caused inflation as well. You know, look at how much money the Premier League spends compared to the Bundesliga, La Liga, Serie A. You know, even when Premier League clubs sell to each other, you know, what would have been, you know, a £300,000 signing 25 years ago? It's now like 28 million. You know, look at the players Bournemouth signed from Liverpool, all reserve players.
Yeah.
All 20, 30 million.
20-odd million, yeah.
So, you know, Swansea were in a position, they hadn't been in the Premier League for that many years. You know, they were quite established at the time. They'd had, what, one foray into Europe? And they're able to tell Everton, we want 45 million. And it's because they had money in the bank, they didn't need to sell them. So, for me, it's the Premier League is, you know, talking about FFP and sustainability. But they've caused the inflation. They've caused the overspending. They've caused the Premier League to just eat itself. And as I say, I worry for a lot of clubs. I think there's a lot of clubs that are in the Premier League in this era who are going to face ruin, basically, just because of the amount of money. And, you know, football goes in cycles. The Premier League isn't always going to be the league that the broadcast rights want. You know, Serie A could come back into fashion. You don't know. Barcelona and Real Madrid may make La Liga the top league again, and all of a sudden that money dwindles, and then it's not going to be Man City or Chelsea who suffer. It's going to be Luton, Bournemouth, Brentford, Brighton, you know, Crystal Palace, all those sort of teams. So I think the Premier League have been very hypocritical and very careless.
And obviously we've been careless as well. We budgeted for, you know, finishing in sixth place and spent accordingly. And as you said, Lyndon, not always wisely. We're not looking at this going, oh, but wasn't it fun having all these glamorous players? A lot of them were, like I say, kind of middling Premier League players who, like Ashley Williams, like Gylfi Sigurdsson, who we overspent, Yannick Bolasie, who just signed for someone, I think.
Swansea.
Oh, wow. It all comes back around. John Nye, by the way, who I Googled based on that Bournemouth comment, at Ebbsfleet United.
Wow.
What a world. That's a bit of a fall from grace. But that's the frustrating thing, that it's not that we've kind of played the Premier League game, we've tried to gamble at the high table, and now we're bust. It's not Portsmouth where you're bringing in players on huge wages and essentially the operation cannot be funded anymore. And obviously that was one of the big takeaways from a points deduction, but the administration penalty, certainly when Portsmouth were punished, was 9 points, and we're getting punished more than that by going 19 and a half million over, still being a funded club, still being a going concern, still paying everyone their wages on time, etc. And this punishment essentially puts us in kind of debtor's prison, because not only does it take away points from our league standing, potentially, it also potentially takes away our Premier League status, which in turn puts our financial security at risk. It really does feel like the wrong punishment. If this was, oh, they spent 19.5 million, I don't know, buying custom boots laced with ryosin or putting tranquilizers in the away side's dressing room or something, it's not that, is it? It's basically spending a bit too much on your credit card and going, oh crap, well, that's my credit score for the next few years. I.e. what we should probably be looking at is some kind of transfer window, embargo for a set period of time, some kind of fine, some kind of penalty that has to be paid back, and a kind of watch your behavior, lads, as opposed to what we're seeing now, which is potentially really quite catastrophic. But that's where I'm hoping, as I say that out loud, someone's listening and just sees a little bit of a sense in it, because the sense is, as we're all kind of agreeing on, it's not been this mad trolley dash. It's not been eight-year contracts. It's not been a country's bought us and another player, so we're going to loan him that player just to move around the puzzle pieces a little bit. It's none of this clever kind of engineering. It's just basically a bit of crap accounting during a turbulent time, during a stadium build, when there's other Premier League sides have obviously had that kind of thrust on the doorstep, quite literally. We've tried to keep up with the Joneses. We've sort of failed, but are still in the game at least. And I think we should be allowed to keep going on the ride a little longer, even if sometimes the other sides of football, like this, like a lot of those sides I mentioned, certainly like VAR, kind of makes you think, well, yeah, I might just go off and watch, I don't know, another league, the Maltese League or the Gibraltar League, and just forget about it all for a little bit and pretend Everton are there instead.
Yeah. All right. Well, Forest next. And in the context of our heart-warring home form, the fact that our next three opponents in the league are Newcastle, Chelsea and City, the fact that we're 5 points from safety, 8 points behind Bournemouth in 16th, Saturday's game against Forest is a big one. It's obviously not ideal to put so much emphasis on one game because it isn't make or break, obviously, in any sense. But nevertheless, 3 points from the City ground would be huge, wouldn't it, Adam?
Yeah, it really would. And it'll be interesting to see what side we see out there, whether Onana's back from fitness, because I feel if there was one real thing missing from that game against United, it was his control on the ball, his drive, the lack of... He isn't a pinball machine, is he? Or if he is, he's kind of, you know, the multi-ball. He can do things a bit differently. And we just look better without him. And I feel like the rest of our side... We've spoken about the likes of Decore being a bit of a weird tyro, kind of does his own thing. Without someone like Onana near him, he does look more ragged. And I think having him back in the side would be massive. I guess the other obvious point from Sunday that we've not touched on is Ashley Young as well. I think I know both of your feelings on this man.
Don't get me started.
I kind of regret it. this is like the verbal equivalent of me dangling my leg out in the air and doing the inevitable. But I do feel if Sean Dyche has got a couple of kind of blind spots that we've sadly kind of not seen corrections to, one is what we touched on before in terms of these games against the quote-unquote bigger, better opposition, certainly at home. The other long-standing one seems to be Ashley Young, because I think, and you don't want to single players out, but it doesn't feel like the case with certain other signings, some of whom we mentioned before, by the way, but it's not one of those Everton players where you think, do you know what? Like, he might come good, or he's frustrating, but let's see, i.e. Alex Iwobi. It's not a homegrown player who sort of sizzles and then fizzles, like Ross Barkley or Tom Davis. It's not someone like a Morpay where you just think, well, you probably shouldn't, you know, be in the side. And, you know, it's a player who was brought in to do the steady Eddie job, to do all the basics, to follow Sean Dyche's plan. They're former teammates. He's supposed to just distill what's on the manager's mind, get it on the pitch and do the real basics. And sadly, week on week, there seems to be an error, it usually seems to be from that area of a pitch. And I know Seamus Coleman's back in training, but how Nathan Patterson must feel at this point, I don't really know. Obviously, he came on at the weekend, but that's the real obvious change for me. He wasn't the only one cup on Sunday, it must be said, but I think Branthwaite making that kind of move against Palace and giving away one penalty and possibly two is one thing, but he's a young player learning his trade, learning the game. Ashley Young now a couple of times this season has lost his head at crucial moments, and the game against Forest is, every game's massive now, isn't it? Let's be frank. But I think, to me, if there's a time to take him out the side, give him a breather for one thing, because we're talking about one of the few Everton players older than me in the squad, which is fun. So give him a breather, take him out the firing line to an extent, because I don't think there's a lot of trust from the fan base in him. And I'd say at this point, it's not that balance that we've started to get in other areas of the pitch. So be interesting to see how Dyche responds to that. But beyond that, I'm quietly confident we can get something. I think there has to be a response after a performance like that against United. And again, the one sort of positive, even though I'm still feeling a bit strange and weirded out by what to make of this Everton side at times this season, is we are creating chances, and some of that luck has to change. And someone like Decore, who obviously missed a gilt-edged chance against United, is that sort of player who will put that to bed and get a crucial goal at times. Again, Dom looks sharp at moments, so I fancy us to get something, but I do feel like Anana in that side and Young out of that side would really tip the balance in my favour. What do you think, El?
Yeah, I think that for context of my frustration about it, if the Premier League said you can have your 10 points back, but you've got to keep playing Ashley Young, I think I'd say I'll stick with the minus 10. Like, I was really pleased. When I say I was really pleased with the signing, where Everton are at, I think it works. You know, if there are injuries, he can come in, he can do a job. He should be nowhere near the team every week from what I've seen on the pitch. It's like on a loop. Yeah. I sit where in the Gladys Street in GT2. So first half, you know, I see the right back regularly, and he'll give away his foul in the first 15 minutes and then be telling the two-man wall what to do as he steps back into the box. And then, you know, that he'll angle a pass and it's not down the line and it's not diagonal. It's like just into the path of one of the opposition central midfielders. And every time he gets caught out and the opposition have a chance. So that for me is something that is just so frustrating, because we've got Nathan Patterson on the bench who, if he has made mistakes, it's because he's young. I've never once come on this podcast and said Nathan Patterson needs to be dropped because he's, you know, he's done this or he's done that. I just think he's a young player, learn his trade. The way he gets better is to play. And, you know, I think this is massively on Dyche, because, you know, we've seen Mikhailenko is a very solid defender, but Young was playing left back at one point as well. And I think, you know, we've seen with James Garner being played out wide, Michael Keane starting the season. You know, that there are those blind spots, and this is probably the biggest, I think. But as well for Dyche, he's got to make substitutions quicker. Against Man United in the second half, 2-0 down, Everton's player just felt so samey, so predictable. And that's where you need a spark. And it doesn't matter if the player you're bringing on isn't good as the player who's going off. It's about an energy, having an impetus. And I feel that Sean Dyche, just too many times, he just waits too long. And I don't know what he's waiting for, you know. I think Chimiti, when he comes on, I think he's got a lot in house. And I think he makes things happen just from his position. And so it's really disappointing that, you know, we've now got options off the bench. Not loads, don't get me wrong. I know that there's not loads of quality on the bench. But I just feel that the 11 that Dyche picks and, you know, four or five players off the bench can win games of football in the Premier League, can come back from a goal down or two, and can change things. And, you know, I often see Sean Dyche talking to Ian Woon or Steve Stone, and I don't know what they're discussing, because it's very clear to me that the change needs to come. So, honestly, out of probably all the managers of the Mascheri era, I think Deitch is the one who frustrates me the most because I see that he does get things right. He is a good manager in terms of setting a team up away from home. And it's just such a shame that, you know, we will stick with players, but we've seen it. You know, I think Roberto Martinez stuck with Tim Howard when Jill Robles had a good run in the team and he went back with Howard. And, you know, these decisions can cost managers their job. You know, because if Everton continue to lose by the odd goal at home and Ashley Young's still playing, Deitch will get the blame for that, whether that's the reason or not. Because we're seeing something that isn't working, which he's persevering with. So, yeah, for me, the Ashley Young, you know, inclusion and, you know, the persistence with him is just really frustrating now because, you know, I'd much rather, if we're going to concede a goal through a mistake, I'd much rather it be through Nathan Patterson, who's learning his trade and will gain from the experience, albeit a negative one, than Ashley Young, who will, you know, soon be hanging up his boots. You know, and that's the thing. If Nathan Patterson's injured, Coleman's injured, Mikulenko's injured, and Ashley Young's not playing, I've got no qualms with that. But really, I do. I think it's a very, very bad call from Deitch because I don't think it's needed. And at the same time, I don't think it's fair on Young. You know, he's making these fouls. He's putting these bad performances in. And Deitch is leaving him out there for far too long.
It's like Michael Keane all over again, isn't it? I feel like it's going to be a situation that will only change once things become so blindingly obvious. He makes, you know, enough errors that lead to goals or whatever that Deitch will change it. I mean, like you, Al, I had no qualms with signing Ashley Young in the first place because of his experience, because of his physical condition, that he's clearly still able to, you know, play at the top level, you know, and last at 90 minutes. But he shouldn't be the first choice, you know. And unfortunately, Deitch is one of these managers that seems to want to err on the side of experience, a bit like David Moyes used to, over, you know, more rational decisions. Hopefully with Seamus Coleman. Seamus Coleman was on the bench. I'm surprised he didn't actually come on in the closing stages actually to get some minutes, but he was obviously on the bench. So, you know, Deitch may have an easy decision to make once Seamus Coleman's fully fit. That obviously doesn't help Nathan Patterson any, and unfortunately, and I feel for Patterson because, you know, I'd much prefer to see him learning his trade in the side, than watch Ashley Young make mistakes that he really should know better than, at his stage of his career, but we'll have to see. I mean, I suspect that Young will be in the team again on Saturday. I don't think that Coleman is quite Deitch fit, in quotes, to make the start. And hopefully Onana's back. I think Idrissa Gueye, he actually had a pretty good game against United. Unfortunately, we saw both sides of his shooting ability. One absolutely awful shot, and then one that was almost a worldie, but for Andre Onana. But in terms of Forest, I mean, they're not in a good place themselves. There's talk again of their ownership being willing to give Steve Cooper time to turn results around. They've got their main striker one year out injured, and I think Ibrahim Sangare has been ill. So it's not the worst time to be playing them. But, you know, and again, there's that ROA record, which has been really, really good. I think last season the difference maker in that fixture was Brennan Johnson. I think without him, we probably would have won there in March. So, yeah. You know, I think go there with the same mindset, the same approach, and we could be sound. But none of these away games are easy, and that's the problem with sort of relying on our away form to kind of carry us through when our home form isn't good, is because it's just that much more difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, my one worry with Forest is Anthony Elanga, who's one of those players, one of many players we've nearly signed over the years, and feels like the sort of person who will... I think he scored in the last game, didn't he, actually? He looks tidy, looks dangerous, and now there's a narrative.
So nailed on, then, that he's going to score.
I feel like... nailed on, yeah. Ashley Young will bring him down, last man, and we'll all say, weren't we clever? But I think... sorry. But I think they have got players who can hurt us, but you're right. I'd say they're less of a threat than they were last season, and obviously they weren't in great shakes last season either. I think we've we could and probably should have enough, but I'd like to see a little bit more now in the play, in the same way we've seen that certain times away. But against United, it did feel pretty route one. It felt like that was the only real way we were going to get on the score sheet. Apart from, you mentioned that that Garner Gay shot from distance, and I remember I knew that wasn't our day when I saw Anana, who every time I've watched him for United has just been absolutely woeful, pull off a really top draw save. That was kind of when you knew. But I think a bit more clinical finishing, better performance from Decore, and we might have enough. One other note on the subs there, Al, that you mentioned. Obviously, we have got options off the bench, but it's worth saying, again, not to sort of harp on negatively about players, but Dan Juma was pretty, pretty awful when he came on against United. And I feel he's obviously been, again, a kind of victim of not being a favourite of Deitch, probably of arriving not fully fit as well. But he's someone who you would expect to see game time in the busy December calendar. So hopefully we can see a bit more of him, because he was one player I was excited about, one player who I felt could make a real difference in the final third, and certainly who I felt was going to be an upgrade on Damari Gray. And so far, besides a little moment against Doncaster, which is kind of in the same realms of Beto, isn't it, I guess, we've not seen too much of him, just because Deitch has kept that settled side. So he's going to need to show something as well. But I also agree that Chimiti looks at the moment like the player who can probably do something off the bench. So yeah, hopefully we'll see a bit more of him as well.
Yeah, I think with Dan Juma, I think he's very much one of those players who needs to be told he's amazing, who needs to feel wanted, because, you know, I might be completely wrong on this, he just looked disinterested against United. He just didn't seem to have to get up and go. And, you know, maybe Deitch could have managed that situation a little better, because I think he was sort of jettisoned out quite quickly and not really given a chance. But what's weird about Dan Juma is he played in that League Cup game in the number 10 role and did absolutely nothing apart from play the two of the best passes I've seen this season. And it's almost like, is it worth having him on the pitch for those little moments? And I think really with a Sean Deitch team, the answer is no, because you need hard workers, you need grafters. But when you look at it in those moments, you know, it's difficult. You need that quality. And I've got to say, I'm very disappointed in Lionel Messi. You know, he's seen Idrissa Gana Gueye on the training pitch at PSG. Just go over to him and tell him not to lean back when you shoot. You know, that could have helped us massively, rather than, you know. So, you know, he goes to PSG. What a great experience, and the best player. And, you know, that could have really helped us. Cause honestly, I can't believe a professional footballer, you see it a mile off, he leans so far back, that ball is only going in one place. So that is a real frustration, to be honest. The Idrissa Gana Gueye and the Decore, you know, they are so hit and miss. Sometimes, you know, Gueye will score a goal like he did at Palace, and other times he'll just put his foot through and it'll go into Rose Ed. It's just, and that's the thing, you know, Sean Dyche's Everton are creating chances, but it's a lottery, isn't it, whether it's going to hit the net or not. So I think Forest is a really tough one to call in a sort of different way to United, but quite similar, that, you know, you don't know what Everton you're going to get. And for, you know, it's a winnable game, but Forest at home, you know, if they get an early goal as well, like United did, then it becomes a very tricky fixture, I think.
Yeah, I think they have one of the best home records in the league over the last year as well. So Forest, you know, Forest at home, playing at home is no easy proposition at all. In terms of a question, not sort of a formal the weekly question, but Matt Jones poses this on the Subs Weekly show, which should be out by now, and I'll put it to you fellas as well, seeing as it's been in the news today. But IFAB, which is the international body for FIFA sticking its nose into football on a near constant basis to see how much it can screw around with the laws of the game, are going to be trialing sin bins as a disciplinary measure, somewhere between yellow and red cards, I imagine. Elle, your immediate thoughts on this, and if it isn't too prejudicial, should it be thrown in the bin straight away along with VAR?
Yeah, well, the first thought I have about a sin bin is Ashley Young will just forever be on and off the pitch, won't he? All the time with his niggly little foul. No, I think you know, football is the best game on the planet for a reason. And, you know, fans loved it for what it was. You don't need to change it. You know, we've seen with VAR, it changes it negatively to the point that, you know, some fans are switching off. Some fans are feeling like it's a bit of a chore. Some fans aren't enjoying match day like they used to. And I think, you know, a sin bin, you know, again, because the officiating isn't great, you know, players are going to be without, you know, teams, sorry, are going to be without players for 10, 20 minutes when they shouldn't. So for me, it's just the case that the refereeing at the moment just isn't good enough to bring in another ruling that will hamper too many teams unfairly. So for me, it's a massive no-no. You know, football has been fine without a sin bin for 120 odd years. Doesn't need it now either.
Yeah, I'd agree with that because, yeah, we would probably end up being deducted 10 minutes on a regular basis. You're right, Ashley Young would probably pull both hamstrings during a regular 90 minutes as well, having to go back and forth to his seat. It's, I think the issue of players surrounding a referee and dissent, we kind of saw that with Decore's booking at the weekend, where that's, I wouldn't say it's the biggest issue in the game, but again, it's a law that's usually unfairly applied. I know I'm saying that obviously from an Evertonian point of view, but there's no real consistency to the way that referees dole out those punishments. Likewise, with diving, which weirdly the referee made a very bold call at 2 or 3 yards from a decision, was overruled. Rightly, in fairness, on reflection, after my hangover had subsided. But I think the fact that we are finding more ways to make complicated what should be quite a simple game. This isn't someone watching a game and going, oh, do you know what? Actually, players passing the ball back to the goalkeeper and him picking it up minute after minute after minute is quite bad, actually. We should make it a little bit quicker, shouldn't we? Because the ball's just going back to the goalkeeper all the time. That's different. It's not a safety issue like, I don't know, you see a sort of throwback challenge from the sort of late 80s, early 90s and go, oh my God, you know, what is Vinnie Jones doing, for example? It's not that. This is just sort of, it's picking at the wrong scab, isn't it, really? And just, there's a mess everywhere as a result of it. So, yeah, no, is my answer to this week's question.
I mean, it's just picking at scabs that don't even exist half the time. That's the thing, you know. It's just so much of the game wasn't broken, and yet they just seem to want to constantly interfere, constantly meddle, and we're seeing the fallout from that in, you know, last night's VAR decision that robbed Newcastle of what would have been a great win in Paris. So it was bloody hilarious if you hate Newcastle. But I mean, you know, you wouldn't have this confusion if they just would stop changing the handball rule to the point where no one actually knows what the rule is anymore. You know, it's in the laws, but UEFA have a different interpretation of it, a different implementation of it. The Premier League does it differently because they couldn't handle the initial one. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a farce. And, you know, I'm of the opinion that the fewer new rules, the better. Stop messing around with the game. And I think that particularly in instances of dissent, you know, these referees are precious enough as it is. You're going to have players in the sin bin all the time, you know, just for slinging the F word at the referee when he's made a ridiculous decision. Like you said, Al, you know, the standard of the refereeing is not up to introducing something like this where you can, you know, you just, as I say, you're going to have these instances happening all the time because people just do not have faith in the referees, and that leads to dissent just by its very nature.
Yeah. And it's gimmicky as well, isn't it? It's all centered around the television fan, like, oh yeah, I've got £5 on Luke Shaw to go in the sin bin on Sunday. Oh, clever. It's that as opposed to actually enjoying the game. And if you're in the ground and you sort of strain your eyes, going, oh, five players surrounded a ref, and I think four of them ended up in the sin bin, but one of them said good gracious and not the F word, so he's not gone in. It's a bit of a farce, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's leave it there. Thanks to Adam and Elle. We'll be back next week to chat all things Everton as we get into a really busy December. Thanks so much for listening, Blues. All the best, and up the irate Toffees.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.